eaten alive by the dark. Don't, she is saying between tough swallows, don't go back. This is worse than when Paul D. came to 124, and she cried helplessly into the stove. This is worse. Then it was for herself. Now she is crying because she has no self. Death is a skipped meal compared to this. She can feel her thickness thinning, dissolving into nothing. She grabs the hair at her temples to get enough to uproot it and halt the melting for a while. Teeth clamped shut. Denver breaks her sobs. She doesn't move to open the door because there's no world out there. She decides to stay in the cold house and let the dark swallow her like the minnows of light above. She won't put up with another leaving, another trick, waking up to find one brother, then another, not at the bottom of the bed, his foot jabbing her spine, sitting at the table eating turnips and saving the liquor for her grandmother to drink, her mother's hand on the keeping room door and her voice saying, Baby Suggs is gone, Denver. And when she got around to worrying about what would be the case if Setha died or Paul D. took her away, a dream come true comes true. Just a lever on a pile of newspaper in the dark. No footfall announces her, but there she is, standing where before there was nobody when Denver looked, and smiling. Denver grabs the hem of beloved skirt. I thought you left me. I thought you went back. Beloved smiles. I don't want that place. This is the place I am. She sits down on the pallet and laughing lies back, looking at the crack lights above. Surreptitiously, Denver pinches a piece of beloved skirt between her fingers and holds on. A good thing she does, because suddenly Beloved sits up. What is it? Asks Denver. Look. She points to the sunlit cracks. What? I don't see nothing. Denver follows the pointing finger. Beloved drops her hand. I'm like this. Denver watches as Beloved bends over, curls up and rocks. Her eyes go to no place. Her moaning is so small, Denver can hardly hear it. You all right, Beloved? Beloved focuses her eyes. Over there. Her face. Denver looks where Beloved's eyes go. There's nothing but darkness there. Whose face? Who is it? Me. It's me. She is smiling again. The last of the Sweet Home Men, so named and called by one who would know, believed it. The other four believed it too, once, but they were long gone. The sold one never returned, the lost one never found. One he knew was dead for sure. One he hoped was, because butter and clabber was no life or reason to live it. He grew up thinking that of all the blacks in Kentucky, only the five of them were men, allowed, encouraged to correct Garner, even defy him, to invent ways of doing things, to see what was needed and attack it without permission, to buy a mother, choose a horse or a wife, handle guns, even learn reading if they wanted to, but they didn't want to, since nothing important to them could be put down on paper. Was that it? Is that where the manhood lay? In the naming done by a white man who was supposed to know, who gave them the privilege not of working, but of deciding how to? No. In their relationship with Garner was true metal. They were believed and trusted, but most of all, they were listened to. He thought what they said had merit, and what they felt was serious. Deferring to his slaves' opinions did not deprive him of authority or power. It was school teacher who taught them otherwise. A truth that waved like a scarecrow in rye. They were only Sweet Home men at Sweet Home. One step off that ground, and they were trespassers among the human race. Watchdogs without teeth, steer bulls without horns, gelded workhorses whose neigh and whinny could not be translated into a language responsible humans spoke. His strength had lain in knowing that schoolteacher was wrong. Now, he wondered, there was Alpha, Georgia, there was Delaware, there was Sixo, and still he wondered. If schoolteacher was right, it explained how he had come to be a rag doll, picked up and put back down anywhere, anytime, by a girl young enough to be his daughter. Fucking her when he was convinced he didn't want to. Whenever she turned her behind up, the calves of his youth, was that it? Cracked his resolve. But it was more than appetite that humiliated him and made him wonder if schoolteacher was right. It was being moved, placed where she wanted him, and there was nothing he was able to do about it. For his life, he could not walk up the glistening white stairs in the evening. For his life, he could not stay in the kitchen, in the keeping room, in the storeroom at night. And he tried, held his breath the way he had when he ducked into the mud, steeled his heart the way he had when the trembling began. But it was worse than that, worse than the blood eddy he had controlled with a sledgehammer. When he stood up from the supper table at 124 and turned toward the stairs, nausea was first, then repulsion. He who had eaten raw meat barely dead, who under plum trees bursting with blossoms, had crunched through a dove's breast before its heart stopped beating. Because he was a man, and a man could do what he would, be still for 6 hours in a dry well while night dropped, fight raccoon with his hands, and win. Watch another man, whom he loved better than his brothers, roast without a tear, just so the roasters would know what a man was like. And it was he, that man, who had walked from Georgia to Delaware, who could not go or stay put where he wanted to in 124. Shame. Paul D. could not command his feet, but he thought he could still talk. And he made up his mind to break out that way. He would tell Setha about the last 3 weeks, catch her alone coming from work at the beer garden she called a restaurant, and tell it all. He waited for her. The winter afternoon looked like dusk as he stood in the alley behind Sawyer's restaurant, rehearsing, imagining her face, and letting the words flock in his head like kids before lining up to follow the leader. This is not the... A man can't... See, but... Oh, listen here. It ain't that. It really ain't. Old Garner... What I mean is, it ain't a weakness, the kind of weakness I can fight, cause something is happening to me. That girl is doing it. I know you think I never liked her know-how, but she is doing it to me. Fixing me, Setha. She fixed me, and I can't break it. What? A grown man fixed by a girl? But what if the girl was not a girl, but something in disguise, a low-down something that looked like a sweet young girl, and fucking her or not was not the point. It was not being able to stay or go where he wished in 124. And the danger was in losing Setha, because he was not man enough to break out. So he needed her, Setha, to help him to know about it. And it shamed him to have to ask the woman he wanted to protect to help him do it, goddammit to hell. Paul D. blew warm breath into the hollow of his cupped hands. The wind raced down the alley so fast it sleeked the fur of four kitchen dogs waiting for scraps. He looked at the dogs. The dogs looked at him. Finally, the back door opened and Setha stepped through, holding a scrap pan in the crook of her arm. When she saw him, she said, "Oh," and her smile was both pleasure and surprise. Paldi believed he smiled back, but his face was so cold he wasn't sure. "Man, you make me feel like a girl, coming by to pick me up after work. Nobody ever did that before. You better watch out. I might start looking forward to it." She tossed the largest bones into the dirt rapidly so the dogs would know there was enough and not fight each other. Then she dumped the skins of some things, heads of other things, and the insides of still more things, what the restaurant could not use and she would not, in a smoking pile near the animal's feet. "Got to rinse this out," she said, "and then I'll be right with you." He nodded as she returned to the kitchen. The dogs ate without sound, and Paldi thought they at least got what they came for. And if she had enough for them... The cloth on her head was brown wool, and she edged it down over her hairline against the wind. "You get off early or what?" "I took off early." "Anything the matter?" "In a way of speaking," he said, and wiped his lips. "Not cut back?" "No, no, they got plenty of work. I just..." "Hmm?" "Setha, you won't like what I'm about to say." She stopped then and turned her face toward him and the hateful wind. Another woman would have squinted, or at least teared, if the wind whipped her face as it did Setha's. Another woman might have shot him a look of apprehension, pleading, anger even, because what he said sure sounded like part one of "Goodbye, I'm Gone." Setha looked at him steadily, calmly, already ready to accept, release, or excuse an in-need-or-trouble man, agreeing, saying, "Okay, all right," in advance, because she didn't believe any of them over the long haul could measure up. And whatever the reason, it was all right. No fault, nobody's fault. He knew what she was thinking. And even though she was wrong, he was not leaving her, wouldn't ever. The thing he had in mind to tell her was going to be worse. So when he saw the diminished expectation in her eyes, the melancholy without blame, he could not say it. He could not say to this woman, who did not squint in the wind, "I am not a man." "Well, say it, Paldi, whether I like it or not." Since he could not say what he planned to, he said something he didn't know was on his mind. "I want you pregnant, Setha. Would you do that for me?" Now she was laughing, and so was he. "You came by here to ask me that? You are one crazy-headed man." "You're right, I don't like it. Don't you think I'm too old to start that all over again?" She slipped her fingers in his hand, for all the world like the hand-holding shadows on the side of the road. "Think about it," he said. And suddenly it was a solution, a way to hold on to her, document his manhood, and break out of the girl's spell, all in one. He put the tips of Setha's fingers on his cheek. Laughing, she pulled him away, lest somebody passing the alley see them misbehaving in public, in daylight, in the wind. Still, he'd gotten a little more time, bought it, in fact, and hoped the price wouldn't wreck him, like paying for an afternoon in the coin of life to come. They left off playing, let go hands, and hunched forward as they left the alley and entered the street. The wind was quieter there, but the dried-out cold it left behind kept pedestrians fast-moving, stiff inside their coats. No men leaned against door frames or storefront windows. The wheels of wagons delivering feed or wood screeched as though they hurt. Hitched horses in front of the saloons shivered and closed their eyes. Four women, walking two abreast, approached, their shoes loud on the wooden walkway. Paul D. touched Setha's elbow to guide her as they stepped from the slats to the dirt to let the women pass. Half an hour later, when they reached the city's edge, Setha and Paul D. resumed catching and snatching each other's fingers, stealing quick pats on the behind. Joyfully embarrassed to be that grown up and that young at the same time. Resolve, he thought, that was all it took, and no motherless gal was going to break it up. No lazy stray pup of a woman could turn him around, make him doubt himself, wonder, plead, or confess. Convinced of it, that he could do it, he threw his arm around Setha's shoulders and squeezed. She let her head touch his chest, and since the moment was valuable to both of them, they stopped and stood that way, not breathing, not even caring if a passerby passed them by. The winter light was low. Setha closed her eyes. Paul D. looked at the black trees lining the roadside, their defending arms raised against attack. Softly, suddenly it began to snow, like a present come down from the sky. Setha opened her eyes to it and said, "Mercy." And it seemed to Paul D. that it was a little mercy, something given to them on purpose, to mark what they were feeling, so they would remember it later on, when they needed to. Down came the dry flakes, fat enough and heavy enough to crash like nickels on stone. It always surprised him how quiet it was, not like rain, but like a secret. "Run," he said. "You run," said Setha. "I've been on my feet all day." "Where I been? Sitting down?" And he pulled her along. "Stop, stop," she said. "I don't have the legs for this." "Then give him to me," he said. And before she knew it, he had backed into her, hoisted her on his back, and was running down the road, past brown fields, turning white. Breathless at last, he stopped, and she slid back down on her own 2 feet, weak from laughter. "You need some babies, somebody to play with in the snow." Setha secured her headcloth. Paul D. smiled and warmed his hands with his breath. "I sure would like to give it a try. Need a willing partner, though." "I'll say," she answered, "very, very willing." It was nearly 4 o'clock now, and 124 was half a mile ahead. Floating toward them, barely visible in the drifting snow, was a figure. And although it was the same figure that had been meeting Setha for 4 months, so complete was the attention she and Paul D. were paying to themselves, they both felt a jolt when they saw her close in. Beloved did not look at Paul D. Her scrutiny was for Setha. She had no coat, no wrap, nothing on her head, but she held in her hands a long shawl. Stretching out her arms, she tried to circle it around Setha. "Crazy girl," said Setha. "You the one out here with nothing on." And stepping away and in front of Paul D., Setha took the shawl and wrapped it around Beloved's head and shoulders, saying, "You got to learn more sense than that." She enclosed her in her left arm. Snowflakes stuck now. Paul D. felt icy cold in the place Setha had been before Beloved came. Trailing a yard or so behind the women, he fought the anger that shot through his stomach all the way home. When he saw Denver silhouetted in the lamplight at the window, he could not help thinking, "And whose ally you?" It was Setha who did it. Unsuspecting, surely, she solved everything with one blow. "Now I know you're not sleeping out there tonight, are you, Paul D?" She smiled at him, and like a friend in need, The chimney coughed against the rush of cold, shooting into it from the sky. Window sashes shuddered in a blast of winter air. Paul D. looked up from the stew meat. "You come upstairs, where you belong," she said, "and stay there." The threads of malice creeping toward him from beloved side of the table were held harmless in the warmth of Setha's smile. Once before, and only once, Paul D. had been grateful to a woman. Crawling out of the woods, cross-eyed with hunger and loneliness, he knocked at the first back door he came to in the colored section of Wilmington. He told the woman who opened it that he'd appreciate doing her woodpile if she could spare him something to eat. She looked him up and down. "A little later on," she said, and opened the door wider. She fed him pork sausage, the worst thing in the world for a starving man, but neither he nor his stomach objected. Later, when he saw pale cotton sheets and two pillows in her bedroom, he had to wipe his eyes quickly, so she would not see the thankful tears of a man's first time. Soil, grass, mud, shucking, leaves, hay, cobs, seashells, all that he'd slept on. White cotton sheets had never crossed his mind. He fell with a groan, and the woman helped him pretend he was making love to her, and not her bed linen. He vowed that night, full of pork, deep in luxury, that he would never leave her. She would have to kill him to get him out of that bed. 18 months later, when he had been purchased by North Point Bank and Railroad Company, he was still thankful for that introduction to sheets. Now he was grateful a second time. He felt as though he had been plucked from the face of a cliff and put down on sure ground. In Setha's bed, he knew he could put up with two crazy girls, as long as Setha made her wishes known. Stretched out to his full length, watching snowflakes stream past the window over his feet, it was easy to dismiss the doubts that took him to the alley behind the restaurant. His expectations of himself were high, too high. What he might call cowardice, other people called common sense. Tucked into the well of his arm, Setha recalled Paul D.'s face in the street when he asked her to have a baby for him. Although she laughed and took his hand, it had frightened her. She thought quickly of how good the sex would be, if that is what he wanted. But mostly, she was frightened by the thought of having a baby once more, needing to be good enough, alert enough, strong enough, that caring, again, having to stay alive just that much longer. Oh, Lord, she thought, deliver me. Unless carefree, mother love was a killer. What did he want her pregnant for? To hold on to her? Have a sign that he passed this way? He probably had children everywhere anyway. 18 years of roaming, he would have to have dropped a few. No. He resented the children she had, that's what. Child, she corrected herself. Child plus beloved, whom she thought of as her own. And that is what he resented, sharing her with girls, hearing the three of them laughing at something he wasn't in on, the code they used among themselves that he could not break. Maybe even the time spent on their needs and not his. They were a family somehow, and he was not the head of it. "Can you stitch this up for me, baby?" "Mm-hmm. Soon as I finish this petticoat. She's just got the one she came here in, and everybody needs a change. Any pie left? I think Denver got the last of it." And not complaining, not even minding that he slept all over and around the house now, which she put a stop to this night out of courtesy. Setha sighed and placed her hand on his chest. She knew she was building a case against him in order to build a case against getting pregnant, and shamed her a little. But she had all the children she needed. If her boys came back one day and Denver and Beloved stayed on, well, it would be the way it was supposed to be, no? right after she saw the shadows holding hands at the side of the road, hadn't the picture altered? And the minute she saw the dress and shoes sitting in the front yard, she broke water. Didn't even have to see the face burning in the sunlight. She'd been dreaming of it for years. Paul D's chest rose and fell under her hand. Denver finished washing the dishes and sat down at the table. Beloved, who had not moved since Setha and Paul D left the room, sat sucking her forefinger. Denver watched her face a while and then said, "She likes him here." Beloved went on probing her mouth with her finger. "Make him go away," she said. "She might be mad at you if he leaves." Beloved, inserting a thumb in her mouth along with a forefinger, pulled out a back tooth. There was hardly any blood, but Denver said, "Ooh, didn't that hurt you?" Beloved looked at the tooth and thought, "This is it." Next would be her arm, her hand, a toe. Pieces of her would drop maybe one at a time, maybe all at once. Or on one of those mornings, before Denver woke, and after Setha left, she would fly apart. It is difficult, keeping her head on her neck, her legs attached to her hips, when she is by herself. Among the things she could not remember was when she first knew that she could wake up any day and find herself in pieces. She had two dreams, exploding and being swallowed. When her tooth came out, an odd fragment last in the row, she thought it was starting. "Must be your wisdom," said Denver. "Don't it hurt?" "Yes." "Then why don't you cry?" "What?" "If it hurts, why don't you cry?" And she did, sitting there, holding a small white tooth in the palm of her smooth, smooth hand, cried the way she wanted to when turtles came out of the water, one behind the other, right after the blood-red bird disappeared back into the leaves, the way she wanted to when Setha went to him, standing in the tub under the stairs. With the tip of her tongue, she touched the salt water that slid to the corner of her mouth and hoped Denver's arm around her shoulders would keep them from falling apart. The couple upstairs, united, didn't hear a sound, but below them, outside, all around 124, the snow went on and on and on, piling itself, burying itself, higher, deeper. In the back of Baby Suggs's mind may have been the thought that if Hallie made it, God do what he would, it would be a cause for celebration. If only this final son could do for himself what he had done for her and for the three children John and Ella delivered to her door one summer night. When the children arrived and no Setha, she was afraid and grateful. Grateful that the part of the family that survived was her own grandchildren, the first and only she would know, two boys and a little girl who was crawling already. But she held her heart still, afraid to form questions. What about Setha and Hallie? Why the delay? Why didn't Setha get on board too? Nobody could make it alone, not only because trappers picked them off like buzzards or netted them like rabbits, but also because you couldn't run if you didn't know how to go. You could be lost forever if there wasn't nobody to show you the way. So when Setha arrived, all mashed up and split open, but with another grandchild in her arms, the idea of a hoop moved closer to the front of her brain. But since there was still no sign of Hallie, and Setha herself didn't know what had happened to him, she let the hoop lie, not wishing to hurt his chances by thanking God too soon. It was Stampede who started it. 20 days after Setha got to 124, he came by and looked at the baby he had tied up in his nephew's jacket, looked at the mother he had handed a piece of fried eel to, and for some private reason of his own, went off with two buckets to a place near the river's edge that only he knew about, where blackberries grew, tasting so good and happy that to eat them was like being in church. Just one of the berries, and you felt anointed. He walked 6 miles to the riverbank, did a slide-run-slide down into a ravine made almost inaccessible by brush. He reached through brambles lined with blood-drawing thorns thick as knives that cut through his shirt sleeves and trousers, all the while suffering mosquitoes, bees, hornets, wasps, and the meanest lady spiders in the state. Scratched, raked, and bitten, he maneuvered through and took hold of each berry with fingertips so gentle not a single one was bruised. Late in the afternoon he got back to 124 and put 2 full buckets down on the porch. When Baby Suggs saw his shredded clothes, bleeding hands, welted face and neck, she sat down laughing out loud. Bugler, Howard, the woman in the bonnet, and Setha came to look, and then laughed along with Baby Suggs at the sight of the sly, steely old black man. Agent, fisherman, boatman, tracker, savior, spy, standing in broad daylight, whipped finally by 2 pails of blackberries. Paying them no mind, he took a berry and put it in the 3-week-old Denver's mouth. The women shrieked, "She's too little for that stamp. Bowsby soup, sickify her stomach." But the baby's thrilled eyes and smacking lips made them follow suit, sampling one at a time the berries that tasted like church. Finally, Baby Suggs slapped the boy's hands away from the bucket and sent Stamp around to the pump to rinse himself. She had decided to do something with the fruit, worthy of the man's labor and his love. That's how it began. She made the pastry dough and thought she ought to tell Ella and John to stop on by, because 3 pies, maybe 4, were too much to keep for one's own. Setha thought they might as well back it up with a couple of chickens. Stamp allowed that perch and catfish were jumping into the boat, didn't even have to drop a line. From Denver's 2 thrilled eyes, it grew to a feast for 90 people. 124 shook with their voices far into the night. 90 people who ate so well and laughed so much it made them angry. They woke up the next morning and remembered the meal-fried perch that Stamp Paid handled with a hickory twig, holding his left palm out against the spit and pop of the boiling grease, the corn pudding made with cream, tired, overfed children asleep in the grass, tiny bones of roasted rabbit still in their hands, and got angry. Baby Suggs's 3, maybe 4, pies grew to 10, maybe 12. Setha's 2 hens became 5 turkeys. The 1 block of ice brought all the way from Cincinnati, over which they poured mashed watermelon mixed with sugar and mint to make a punch, became a wagon load of ice cakes for a washed tub full of strawberry shrug. 124, rocking with laughter, goodwill, and food for 90, made them angry. Too much, they thought. Where does she get it all, Baby Suggs Holy? Why is she and hers always the center of things? How come she always knows exactly what to do and when? Giving advice, passing messages, healing the sick, hiding fugitives, loving, cooking, cooking, loving, preaching, singing, dancing, and loving everybody like it was her job and hers alone. Now to take 2 buckets of blackberries and make 10, maybe 12 pies, to have turkey enough for the whole town pretty near. New peas in September. Fresh cream but no cow. Ice and sugar. Batter bread, bread pudding, raised bread, shortbread. They made them mad. Loaves and fishes were his powers. They did not belong to an ex-slave who had probably never carried 100 pounds to the scale or picked okra with a baby on her back, who had never been lashed by a 10-year-old white boy, as God knows they had, who had not even escaped slavery, had in fact been bought out of it by a doting son and driven to the Ohio River in a wagon, free papers folded between her breasts, driven by the very man who had been her master, who also paid her resettlement fee, name of Garner, and rented a house with 2 floors and a well from the Bodwins, the white brother and sister who gave stamp paid Ella and John clothes, goods, and gear for runaways because they hated slavery worse than they hated slaves. It made them furious. They swallowed baking soda the morning after to calm the stomach violence caused by the bounty, the reckless generosity on display at 124, whispered to each other in the yards about fat rats, doom, and uncalled-for pride. The scent of their disapproval lay heavy in the air. Baby Suggs woke to it and wondered what it was as she boiled hominy for her grandchildren. Later, as she stood in the garden, chopping at the tight soil over the roots of the pepper plants, she smelled it again. She lifted her head and looked around. Behind her, some yards to the left, Setha squatted in the pole beans. Her shoulders were distorted by the greased flannel under her dress to encourage the healing of her back. Near her, in a bushel basket, was a 3-week-old baby. Baby Suggs Holy looked up. The sky was blue and clear, not one touch of death in the definite green of the leaves. She could hear birds, and faintly, the stream way down in the meadow. The puppy, here boy, was burying the last bones from yesterday's party. From somewhere at the side of the house came the voices of Buechler, Howard, and the crawling girl. Nothing seemed amiss, yet the smell of disapproval was sharp. Back beyond the vegetable garden, closer to the stream but in full sun, she had planted corn. Much as they'd picked for the party, there were still ears ripening, which she could see from where she stood. Baby Suggs leaned back into the peppers and the squash vines with her hoe. Carefully, with the blade at just the right angle, she cut through a stalk of insistent rue. Its flowers she stuck through a split in her hat. The rest she tossed aside. The quiet clock, clock, clock of wood splitting reminded her that Stamp was doing the chore he promised to the night before. She sighed at her work, and a moment later straightened up to sniff the disapproval once again. Resting on the handle of the hoe, she concentrated. She was accustomed to the knowledge that nobody prayed for her. But this free-floating repulsion was new. It wasn't white folks, that much she could tell, so it must be colored ones. And then she knew. Her friends and neighbors were angry at her because she had overstepped, given too much, offended them by excess. Baby closed her eyes. Perhaps they were right. Suddenly, behind the disapproving odor, way, way back behind it, she smelled another thing, dark and coming, something she couldn't get at because the other odor hid it. She squeezed her eyes tight to see what it was, but all she could make out was high-topped shoes she didn't like the look of. Thwarted, yet wondering, she chopped away with the hoe. What could it be, this dark and coming thing? What was left to hurt her now? News of Hallie's death? No. She had been prepared for that better than she had for his life. The last of her children, whom she barely glanced at when he was born, because it wasn't worth the trouble to try to learn features you would never see change into adulthood anyway. 7 times she had done that, held a little foot, examined the fat fingertips with her own fingers she never saw become the male or female hands a mother would recognize anywhere. She didn't know to this day what their permanent teeth looked like or how they held their heads when they walked. Did Patty lose her lisp? What color did Famous's skin finally take? Was that a cleft in Johnny's chin or just a dimple that would disappear soon as his jawbone changed? 4 girls, and the last time she saw them, there was no hair under their arms. Does Idelia still love the burned bottom of bread? 7 were gone or dead. What would be the point of looking too hard at that youngest one? But for some reason, they let her keep him. He was with her everywhere. When she hurt her hip in Carolina, she was a real bargain, costing less than Hallie, who was 10 then, for Mr. Garner, who took them both to Kentucky to a farm he called Sweet Home. Because of the hip, she jerked like a 3-legged dog when she walked. But at Sweet Home, there wasn't a rice field or tobacco patch in sight, and nobody knocked her down. Not once. Lillian Garner called her Jenny for some reason, but she never pushed, hit, or called her mean names. Even when she slipped in cow dung and broke every egg in her apron, nobody said, "You black bitch, what's the matter with you?" And nobody knocked her down. Sweet Home was tiny compared to the places she had been. Mr. Garner, Mrs. Garner, herself, Hallie, and 4 boys, over half named Paul, made up the entire population. Mrs. Garner hummed when she worked. Mr. Garner acted like the world was a toy he was supposed to have fun with. Neither wanted her in the field. Mr. Garner's boys, including Hallie, did all of that, which was a blessing, since she could not have managed it anyway. What she did was stand beside the humming Lillian Garner, while the two of them cooked, preserved, washed, ironed, made candles, clothes, soap and cider, fed chickens, pigs, dogs and geese, milked cows, churned butter, rendered fat, laid fires. Nothing to it. And nobody knocked her down. Her hip hurt every single day, but she never spoke of it. Only Hallie, who had watched her movements closely for the last 4 years, knew that to get in and out of bed, she had to lift her thigh with both hands, which was why he spoke to Mr. Garner about buying her out of there so she could sit down for a change. Sweet boy, the one person who did something hard for her, gave her his work, his life, and now his children, whose voices she could just make out as she stood in the garden, wondering what was the dark and coming thing behind the scent of disapproval. Sweet Home was a marked improvement, no question, and no matter, for the sadness was at her center, the desolated center where the self that was no self made its home. Sad as it was that she did not know where her children were buried, or what they looked like, if alive. Fact was, she knew more about them than she knew about herself, having never had the map to discover what she was like. Could she sing? Was it nice to hear when she did? Was she pretty? Was she a good friend? Could she have been a loving mother, a faithful wife? Have I got a sister? And does she favor me? If my mother knew me, would she like me? In Lillian Garner's house, exempted from the field work that broke her hip and the exhaustion that drugged her mind. In Lillian Garner's house, where nobody knocked her down or up, she listened to the white woman humming at her work, watched her face light up when Mr. Garner came in and thought, "It's better here, but I'm not." The Garners, it seemed to her, ran a special kind of slavery, treating them like paid labor, listening to what they said, teaching what they wanted known. And he didn't stud his boys, never brought them to her cabin with directions to lay down with her, like they did in Carolina, or rented their sex out on other farms. It surprised and pleased her, but worried her too. Would he pick women for them? Or what did he think was going to happen when those boys ran smack into their nature? Some danger he was courting, and he surely knew it. In fact, his order for them not to leave Sweet Home, except in his company, was not so much because of the law, but the danger of men-bred slaves on the loose. Baby Suggs talked as little as she could get away with, because what was there to say? That the roots of her tongue could manage? So the white woman, finding her new slave excellent if silent help, hummed to herself while she worked. When Mr. Garner agreed to the arrangements with Hallie, and when Hallie looked like it meant more to him that she go free than anything in the world, she let herself be taken across the river. Of the two hard things, standing on her feet till she dropped, or leaving her last and probably only living child, she chose the hard thing that made him happy, and never put to him the question she put to herself. What for? What does a 60-odd-year-old slave woman who walks like a 3-legged dog need freedom for? And when she stepped foot on free ground, she could not believe that Hallie knew what she didn't, that Hallie, who had never drawn one free breath, knew that there was nothing like it in this world. It scared her. Something's the matter. What's the matter? What's the matter? She asked herself. She didn't know what she looked like and was not curious. But suddenly she saw her hands and thought, with a clarity as simple as it was dazzling, "These hands belong to me. These my hands." Next, she felt a knocking in her chest and discovered something else new. Her own heartbeat. Had it been there all along, this pounding thing? She felt like a fool and began to laugh out loud. Mr. Garner looked over his shoulder at her with wide brown eyes and smiled himself. "What's funny, Jenny?" She couldn't stop laughing. "My heart's beating," she said. And it was true. Mr. Garner laughed. "Nothing to be scared of, Jenny. Just keep your same ways. You'll be all right." She covered her mouth to keep from laughing too loud. "These people I'm taking you to will give you what help you need. Name of Bodwin, a brother and a sister, Scots. I've been knowing them for 20 years or more." Baby Suggs thought it was a good time to ask him something she had long wanted to know. "Mr. Garner," she said, "why you call me Jenny?" "'Cause that's what's on your sales ticket, gal. Ain't that your name? What you call yourself?" "Nothing," she said. "I don't call myself nothing." Mr. Garner went red with laughter. "When I took you out of Carolina, Whitlow called you Jenny, and Jenny Whitlow is what his bill said. Didn't he call you Jenny?" "No, sir. If he did, I didn't hear it." "What did you answer to?" "Anything. But Suggs is what my husband named." "You got married, Jenny? I didn't know it." "Manner of speaking. You know where he is, this husband?" "No, sir." "Is that Hallie's daddy?" "No, sir." "Why you calling him Suggs, then? His bill of sale says Whitlow, too, just like yours." "Suggs is my name, sir, for my husband. He didn't call me Jenny. What did he call you? Baby? Well, said Mr. Garner, going pink again, if I was you, I'd stick to Jenny Whitlow. Mrs. Baby Suggs ain't no name for a freed Negro. Maybe not, she thought, but Baby Suggs was all she had left of the husband she claimed, a serious, melancholy man who taught her how to make shoes. The two of them made a pact. Whichever one got a chance to run would take it, together if possible, alone if not, and no looking back. He got his chance, and since she never heard otherwise, she believed he made it. Now how could he find or hear tell of her, if she was calling herself some bill of sale name? She couldn't get over the city. More people than Carolina, and enough white folks to stop the breath. Two-story buildings everywhere, and walkways made of perfectly cut slats of wood, roads wide as Garner's whole house. This is a city of water, said Mr. Garner. Everything travels by water, and what the rivers can't carry, the canals take. A queen of a city, Jenny. Everything you ever dreamed of, they make it right here. Iron stoves, buttons, ships, shirts, hairbrushes, paint, steam engines, books, a sewer system, make your eyes bug out. Oh, this is a city, all right, if you have to live in a city. This is it. The Bodwins lived right in the center of a street full of houses and trees. Mr. Garner leaped out and tied his horse to a solid iron post. Here we are. Baby picked up her bundle, and with great difficulty, caused by her hip and the hours of sitting in a wagon, climbed down. Mr. Garner was up the walk and on the porch before she touched ground, but she got a peep at a Negro girl's face at the open door before she followed a path to the back of the house. She waited what seemed a long time before this same girl opened the kitchen door and offered her a seat by the window. "Can I get you anything to eat, ma'am?" the girl asked. "No, darling. I'd look favorable on some water, though." The girl went to the sink and pumped a cup full of water. She placed it in Baby Suggs's hand. "I'm Janie, ma'am." Baby, marveling at the sink, drank every drop of water, although it tasted like a serious medicine. "Suggs," she said, blotting her lips with the back of her hand. "Baby Suggs." "Glad to meet you, Mrs. Suggs. You going to be staying here?" "I don't know where I'll be. Mr. Garner, that's him what brought me here, he say he arranged something for me. And then, I'm free, you know." Janie smiled. "Yes, ma'am." "Your people live around here?" "Yes, ma'am. All us live out on Bluestone." "We scattered," said Baby Suggs, "but maybe not for long." Great God, she thought, where do I start? Get somebody to write old Whitlow? See who took Patty and Rosalie? Somebody named Dunn got an idea and went west, she heard. No point in trying for Tyree or John. They cut 30 years ago, and if she searched too hard and they were hiding, finding them would do them more harm than good. Nancy and Famous died in a ship off the Virginia coast before it set sail for Savannah, that much she knew. The overseer at Whitlow's place brought her the news, more from a wish to have his way with her than from the kindness of his heart. The captain waited 3 weeks in port to get a full cargo before setting off. Of the slaves in the hold who didn't make it, he said, two were Whitlow Pickaninny's name of, but she knew their names. She knew, and covered her ears with her fists to keep from hearing them come from his mouth. Janie heated some milk and poured it in a bowl next to a plate of cornbread. After some coaxing, Baby Suggs came to the table and sat down. She crumbled the bread into the hot milk and discovered she was hungrier than she had ever been in her life, and that was saying something. "They gonna miss this?" "No," said Janie. "Eat all you want. It's ours. Anybody else live here? Just me. Mr. Woodruff, he does the outside chores. He comes by 2-3 days a week. Just you two? Yes, ma'am. I do the cooking and washing. Maybe your people know of somebody looking for help. I'd be sure to ask, but I know they take women at the slaughterhouse. Doing what? I don't know. Something men don't want to do, I reckon. My cousin said you get all the meat you want, plus 25 cents the hour. She makes summer sausage. Baby Suggs lifted her hand to the top of her head. Money. Money. They would pay her money every single day? Money? Where is this here slaughterhouse? She asked. Before Janie could answer, the Baldwins came into the kitchen with a grinning Mr. Garner behind. Undeniably brother and sister, both dressed in gray, with faces too young for their snow-white hair. Did you give her anything to eat, Janie? Asked the brother. Yes, sir. Keep your seat, Janie, said the sister, and that good news got better. When they asked what work she could do, instead of reeling off the hundreds of tasks she had performed, she asked about the slaughterhouse. She was too old for that, they said. She's the best cobbler you ever see, said Mr. Garner. Cobbler? Sister Baldwin raised her black, thick eyebrows. Who taught you that? Was the slave taught me, said Baby Suggs. New boots or just repair? New, old, anything. Well, said Brother Baldwin, that'll be something, but you'll need more. What about taking in wash? Asked Sister Baldwin. Yes, ma'am. 2 cents a pound. Yes, ma'am, but where's the inn? What? You said take in wash. Where is the inn? Where am I going to be? Oh, just listen to this, Jenny, said Mr. Garner. These two angels got a house for you. Place they own out of ways. It had belonged to their grandparents before they moved in town. Recently it had been rented out to a whole parcel of Negroes who had left the state. It was too big a house for Jenny alone, they said, 2 rooms upstairs, 2 down. But it was the best and the only thing they could do. In return for laundry, some seamstress work, a little canning and so on, oh, shoes too, they would permit her to stay there, provided she was clean. The past parcel of colored wasn't. Baby Suggs agreed to the situation, sorry to see the money go, but excited about a house with steps. Never mind, she couldn't climb them. Mr. Garner told the Baldwins that she was a right fine cook, as well as a fine cobbler, and showed his belly and the sample on his feet. Everybody laughed. Anything you need, let us know, said the sister. We don't hold with slavery, even Garner's kind. Tell 'em, Jenny, you live any better on any place before mine? No, sir, she said, no place. How long was you at Sweet Home? 10 year, I believe. Ever go hungry? No, sir. Cold? No, sir. Anybody lay a hand on you? No, sir. Did I let Hallie buy you or not? Yes, sir, you did, she said, thinking, but you got my boy. And I'm all broke down. You be renting him out to pay for me way after I'm gone to glory. Woodruff, they said, would carry her out there, they said, and all three disappeared through the kitchen door. I'll have to fix supper now, said Janie. I'll help, said Baby Suggs. You too short to reach the fire. It was dark when Woodruff clicked the horse into a trot. He was a young man with a heavy beard and a burned place on his jaw. The beard did not hide. You born up here? Baby Suggs asked him. No, ma'am, Virginia. Been here a couple years. I see. You go into a nice house. Big, too. A preacher and his family was in there. 18 children. Have mercy. Where they go? Took off to Illinois. Bishop Allen gave him a congregation up there. Big. What churches around here? I ain't set foot in one in 10 years. How come? Wasn't none. I disliked the place I was before this last one, but I did get to church every Sunday some kind of way. I bet the Lord done forgot who I am by now. Go see Reverend Pike, ma'am. He'll reacquaint you. I won't need him for that. I can make my own acquaintance. What I need him for is to reacquaint me with my children. He can read and write, I reckon. Sure. Good. 'Cause I got a lot of digging up to do. But the news they dug up was so pitiful, she quit. After 2 years of messages written by the preacher's hand, 2 years of washing, sewing, canning, cobbling, gardening, and sitting in churches, all she found out was that the Whitlow place was gone, and that you couldn't write to a man named Dunn if all you knew was that he went west. The good news, however, was that Hallie got married and had a baby coming. She fixed on that and her own brand of preaching. Having made up her mind about what to do with the heart that started beating the minute she crossed the Ohio River. And it worked out just fine, until she got proud and let herself be overwhelmed by the sight of her daughter-in-law and Hallie's children, one of whom was born on the way, and have a celebration of blackberries that put Christmas to shame. Now she stood in the garden, smelling disapproval, feeling a dark and coming thing, and seeing high-topped shoes that she didn't like the look of at all, at all. When the four horsemen came, schoolteacher, one nephew, one slave catcher, and the sheriff, the house on Bluestone Road was so quiet they thought they were too late. Three of them dismounted, one stayed in the saddle, his rifle ready, his eyes trained away from the house to the left and to the right, because likely as not, the fugitive would make a dash for it. Although sometimes, you could never tell, you'd find them folded up tight somewhere, beneath floorboards, in a pantry, once in a chimney. Even then care was taken, because the quietest ones, the ones you pulled from a press, a hayloft, or that once from a chimney, would go along nicely for 2 or 3 seconds. Caught red-handed, so to speak, they would seem to recognize the futility of outsmarting a white man, and the hopelessness of outrunning a rifle, smile even, like a child caught dead with his hand in the jelly jar. And when you reached for the rope to tie him, well, even then you couldn't tell. The very nigger with his head hanging and a little jelly jar smile on his face could all of a sudden roar like a bull or some such and commence to do disbelievable things, grab the rifle at its mouth, throw himself at the one holding it, anything. So you had to keep back a pace, leave the tying to another. Otherwise you ended up killing what you were paid to bring back alive. Unlike a snake or a bear, a dead nigger could not be skinned for profit and was not worth his own dead weight in coin. 6 or 7 Negroes were walking up the road toward the house, 2 boys from the slave catcher's left and some women from his right. He motioned them still with his rifle, and they stood where they were. The nephew came back from peeping inside the house, and after touching his lips for silence, pointed his thumb to say that what they were looking for was round back. The slave catcher dismounted then and joined the others. Schoolteacher and the nephew moved to the left of the house, himself and the sheriff to the right. A crazy old nigger was standing in the woodpile with an axe. You could tell he was crazy right off because he was grunting, making low cat noises like. About 12 yards beyond that nigger was another one, a woman with a flower in her hat. Crazy too, probably, because she too was standing stock still, but fanning her hands as though pushing cobwebs out of her way. Both, however, were staring at the same place, a shed. Nephew walked over to the old nigger boy and took the axe from him. Then all four started toward the shed. Inside, two boys bled in the sawdust and dirt at the feet of a nigger woman, holding a blood-soaked child to her chest with one hand and an infant by the heels in the other. She did not look at them. She simply swung the baby toward the wall planks, missed, and tried to connect a second time, when out of nowhere, in the ticking time, the men spent staring at what there was to stare at, the old nigger boy, still mewing, ran through the door behind them and snatched the baby from the arch of its mother's swing. Right off it was clear, to school teacher especially, that there was nothing there to claim. The three, now four, because she'd had the one coming when she cut, pickaninnies,